You're listening to the Talking Rheumatology Spotlight podcast, brought to you by the British Society for Rheumatology.
Hi, everybody. You're very welcome to this podcast. My name is Ashley Elliott, and I'm a rheumatology registrar based in Belfast. Today, the focus of our podcast is just looking at the process, outcomes, and current application of the NICE guidance looking at spondyloarthritis. We're very lucky to be joined by Carol McCrum, who's a consultant physiotherapist at the East Sussex Healthcare Trust and a visiting research fellow at the University of Brighton, and Dr. Nicola Goodson, who is a consultant rheumatologist at the Liverpool University Foundation Trust. And they were both involved in the NICE guidance that was developed in February 2017. So, guys, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for asking us.
So, firstly, if I can just start, I'll just ask the same question to both of you, actually. How did you get involved in the NICE guidance?
Shall I go first?
Yeah, sure, Nicola, yeah.
So I didn't start at the beginning. I was co-opted in. It was a very large group at that stage, and I think somebody had to resign from the committee. And I was just asked if I was interested in taking part, and I was interviewed and accepted onto the committee. But that was way back in 2015, I think.
Very good, yeah. And Carol, same question to you.
I guess I was also approached by someone else to see if I was interested in being on the committee, thinking that there would be lots of very expert physios involved with AS being on it. But I guess what I brought to it, and I was working in a lot of spinal clinics and MSK clinics and really bumping up against a lot of people that weren't being recognised, and it was a real challenge to get them on a rheumatology pathway when I was sitting in those clinics. And I could just see that, you know, the terrible impacts and distress people were in. And so I got really passionate about it, you know, from a different perspective, really. So, you know, I was just so pleased to be part of the guideline development, you know, group with what I learnt and what we all learnt together with developing guidance that could be helpful.
Yeah, great. And Nicola, could you just take us through, just in brief, how a team goes about developing NICE guidance?
Well, as you can probably tell, this started in 2014, and I think it was NICE were approached by the Department of Health to see if they could work on developing evidence-based guidelines for the management of spondyloarthritis. I think they put out a call for interested people, which covers a very broad span of specialities and experience. It sort of encompasses consultant rheumatologists, expert physiotherapists, primary care representation, and lay people were on the committee. And then experts were co-opted in throughout the process to perhaps give a more specialist radiology input and gastroenterology input. And spondyloarthropathy is a very large umbrella, and it kind of encompasses a whole range of different things. And I understand for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to focus largely on axial spondyloarthritis rather than the more peripheral spondyloarthropathies. So I understand that in 2015, before I started, there were lots of research questions that were kind of put together. And there was a huge number of them covering all of these different areas. And over the following 2.5 years, this was broken down into section areas, and the committee met, I don't know how many times, it felt like it was every few months, to appraise the evidence that had been collected by the very experienced NICE technology team, and to discuss, you know, what our interpretation of that evidence meant and how it reflected on our clinical practice and our experience. I think NICE guidance is good because it's set out to be an evidence-based guideline, but where there is no evidence, you have to rely on expert opinion. And I think that's sometimes where, you know, everything reads a little bit woolly sometimes, because there just isn't the evidence there. And I think certainly my experience of this guideline was we kept covering these questions, and the answer was, well, there's no evidence. There's no evidence to actually provide a statement from NICE on that. And so a lot of the guideline is made up of research recommendations to actually generate the evidence to support those answers to those questions going forward. But it is quite a long, drawn out process. And obviously within the room of people with many different backgrounds and areas of expertise, there was often quite heated discussion. And I do remember, you know, being kind of coaxed on by the chair of the whole process, saying, come on, you've got to make a decision. What's your statement on this? And so I think we did eventually meet consensus, and there was a lot of consideration. It was actually quite a lot of work, wasn't it? A lot of reading, understanding the evidence and discussion. It was interesting, enjoyable, but also quite challenging at times. I don't know what your thoughts are, Carol. Does that reflect what you experienced?
Absolutely. And I guess the reason for the guidelines was to help sort of some disparity across the country with what happens. And I guess even in the room, you know, we brought such different local experiences to it and different challenges that we had. And absolutely that issue about the evidence, and certainly for AS or ACSPA, you know, so many of the studies were older studies, and, you know, they were male populations, and they'd had really established disease for a long time. So all the things, I guess, we were trying to find evidence for making a difference. So it's really quite challenging with that as our background. And you can read in the guidance about our decisions and how we tried to, how we came to some of the recommendations or didn't, which is the nice thing about NICE, if anybody's interested. So, yeah, it was a great experience, and lots to learn, and lots to learn to think about how to make a good guidance that has utility for people, really. We spent lots of time trying to think about what its format should be. Mm. Absolutely.
That's very interesting. So just, Carol, then, just going on then, looking at the guidance itself, one of the key points in the guidance was about recognition. When is it important for primary care doctors to be referring and other healthcare professionals to be referring in with suspected spondyloarthritis? When should that really be suspected, and things like key criteria?
Absolutely important, and primary care is absolutely key in being aware about what we need to look for. And there's one really key beginning factor, and that's understanding how inflammatory back pain presents as a presentation. And it hasn't featured very strongly at all in MSK literature. I think there are only two articles that feature inflammatory back pain, the words, in MSK sort of core journals. So it's not something that's very, very familiar in rheumatology circles. So I think that's really key. And rheumatologists are very aware of inflammatory back pain. So it's really important that MSK clinicians are aware of what those features are. And there's a body of features that make us think something's more strongly inflammatory than mechanical. And those things are things that are less likely to be mechanical, such as no sort of good explanation for back pain coming on. So an insidious onset. Of course, prolonged morning stiffness, which is a feature of inflammatory tissue anyway, but prolonged morning stiffness for someone with back pain that doesn't resolve quickly as you would sort of expect a mechanical problem would. Another fairly typical feature is inflammatory back pain improves with movement and with exercise, which is not so typical for mechanical problems, where activity is often an aggravating factor. So these people find it beneficial to move. And the converse is they're really unhelped by staying still and resting. They would find that exacerbates the problem compared to mechanical back pain that often sort of prefers to not being active and give it a break. Another really typical feature of it is that their sleep's disturbed, but what's characteristic is they're woken, they get to sleep often, but they're woken in the second half of the night when the inflammatory sort of condition really affects them. So they'll describe being woken in the second half of the night or early morning because of their back pain, and that they may need to have to even get up and move. And the other key factor is the sacroiliitis feature that is suspicious, and so that's about having buttock pain or alternating buttock pain. So NICE sort of drew on those features and tried to use the ones that gave us sort of the best suspicion rate and the best hit rate. And so what's really key about trying to think about recognizing possible suspicion of AxSpA is that people have a persistent problem. So back pain that's lasted longer than 3 months. And it's very typical that it's a younger person, a younger adult's problem. And so it's unlikely that people have AxSpA beyond 45 years. So it's really, really important when we ask someone about their back pain, we understand when their first onset of back pain is. So someone who's had back pain for longer than 3 months and onset before 45 years. And then NICE came up with other criteria to try and help referral and help us develop a strong suspicion. And so their suggestion is if there's four additional signs, symptoms and risk factors, then it definitely warrants a referral to rheumatology. And so some of those are features in flatulent back pain. And one of that is if their back pain starts before the age of 35, then the likelihood of it being AxSpA is much stronger. The waking in the second half of the night and the buttock pain pointing towards SOJ involvement and the improvement with activity and worse with rest. And the other feature that seems characteristic is it being responsive to NSAIDs. And not everybody can tolerate NSAIDs or take them, but it is a characteristic of an inflammatory back pain problem and actually a first-line treatment. So it's really important that we understand what medications are on and whether they're and what they're responsive to. And the other characteristics are things that make us suspicious of spinal arthritis generally. So whether they've got a past or current history of enthesitis, so tendon attachment pain and commonly in the heel, so plantar fasciitis and Achilles tendons, but not always. So a history of enthesitis. And there's other extra-articular features that are really key in us being suspicious as well and are really essential that we ask. And that's about psoriasis or a family history of psoriasis, which is a risk factor, so a parent or a sibling creates a risk for it being AxSpA. Inflammatory bowel disease, so Crohn's or colitis, and a history of uveitis. So those features also add to our suspicion that a back problem could be AxSpA. And having a past history of inflammatory arthritis, so a peripheral inflammatory arthritis, also points to the fact that we need to check whether they're back symptoms. And finally, a history of axial spinal arthritis or AS, of course, is a risk factor too. So those features are really, really important to ask about and really should shape our screening process for working out whether we've got someone in front of us with a back problem that could be potentially AxSpA. There's one other feature, and that's HLA-B27 positivity, which is associated with the potential of having AxSpA. But it's really important to understand that people can be negative and still be diagnosed with AxSpA, and they may be positive and never, ever develop axial spine arthritis. But there is a recommendation if there's HLA positivity, then that also supports a rheumatology referral, Ash.
Thank you so much, Carl. That's really useful. Nicola, then, just thinking then the next stage when they come to see rheumatology, in terms of what are the key investigations in terms of diagnosis and spondyloarthropathy, and have there been any additional tests that have been developed since the guidance?
So, I mean, I use ASAS or New York classification criteria to help determine whether patients can be given a clear diagnosis. And looking back at my recent letters, you know, a patient who presents with back pain, possibly with some spondyloarthritis features, you know, their working diagnosis is, you know, chronic inflammatory back pain under investigation for axial spondyloarthritis. And it's, I always think, and I think Carol's explained quite beautifully there, how complex it is, all the different features you need to put together and to try and actually get the picture of what the diagnosis is. And I think when you actually hear that very detailed explanation, it is complicated and it's completely understandable why, you know, consideration of this as a possible diagnosis sometimes gets missed and contributes to the prolonged delay that many of these patients get before they get their diagnosis. So, as Carol's touched on, it's a mixture of their clinical presentation, whether they have SPA features such as a history of uveitis, inflammatory bowel disease or psoriasis, what their HLA-B27 status is, and then combining that with imaging findings. So I still x-ray sacroiliac joints as the first imaging investigation, unless the patient's very young, and I try and avoid x-raying young women of childbearing age. If the x-ray is normal and I've got a high suspicion of axial spondyloarthritis, I will go on to request MRI imaging of the spine. And this is often the first imaging investigation we use in younger patients or in young women of childbearing age to try and reduce radiation. And it's a bit like putting together a jigsaw puzzle to get what the picture is. You know, each kind of component of their history, their response to NSAIDs, their imaging, their HLA-B27 status, whether their inflammatory markers are elevated or not, all put together a picture which allows you to make a fairly convincing diagnosis of axial spondyloarthritis. Use of criteria is really helpful, and I do rely on ASAS for axial spondyloarthritis, but it's lovely when you see a patient and you can flick back through their previous imaging and see they've got clear sacroiliitis on an abdominal x-ray that was perhaps done a few years ago. You can make the diagnosis there and then in clinic, which is really, really good, but not really good if it could have been made several years ago because it's not been commented on by radiology. Those are kind of the main things that we do. I'm not aware of any new tests or investigations that are more reliable than, you know, putting together the clinical picture with imaging and blood testing.
Sure. Great. Carol, just then, in terms of MRI, what is there a particular MRI scanning we should be requesting when we're requesting MRI scans in people with suspicion of axial spondyloarthritis? And should we be involving radiology if clinical suspicion is high? Do you have this in your own unit where you have a sort of a multidisciplinary unit with radiology input?
Ash, yeah, MRI, the MRI effect is really, really important. I think certainly in primary care and for pre-diagnosis, it's really important for clinicians to understand that a lumbar spine MRI does not investigate fracture. It's not the right protocol. And having findings on lumbar spine MRI, which can be really quite common, certainly doesn't exclude it. So it's really important if we're suspicious of axSpA that we're using the right protocol, which would be either an AS protocol or an axSpA arthritis protocol or an inflammatory back pain protocol. And what's really important about that is they use a protocol that tries to detect inflammation. And so what they'll use for that is a T1 and a STIR. And the other really important factor about that is it will image the SIJs, which doesn't happen in the lumbar spine imaging, with particular views, and also take sagittals. The recommendation for NICE was to do the SIJs and to do the whole spine. So in the UK, including the cervicothoracic region and the thoracolumbar region, they often just take extended views. So super important that's the right imaging that's done. Along with diagnosis, interpreting MRIs in axSpA is not always very straightforward, and we've all had experiences where it really can take sometimes specialist knowledge, MSK knowledge, to be able to interpret the images well. And so it was a big enough issue for NICE to make a recommendation that if the findings were negative or there weren't any findings and you still had a strong clinical suspicion, that we're encouraged to see if we can get a specialist musculoskeletal radiologist to report on the imaging. Sometimes they're really bound door and we can see it ourselves, but sometimes it's quite subtle, and it's really important that you get the specialist opinion, because it makes a very big difference to management if someone's has findings or not. So, and we do that locally, Ash. If someone's MRI hasn't been reported by our MSK specialist and it's been reported as negative, then we will take it to our radiology MVM, and it's really valuable. Sometimes there's something unequivocal or equivocal, and they can't tell, and they're really helpful in guiding us about whether we need to do an interval imaging in 6 months' time. So it's a really collaborative approach. The other thing that Nicola raised was pediatric imaging. So they can be very, very tricky, even just because of what they're like. So there was a recommendation really to get those reported by a pediatric specialist. So that issue about if it was negative and you're still strongly suspicious, that you might get advice about whether there's an opinion to re-image them if you're still suspicious. And certainly that's something we do, and it's the report has been changed and amended enough times to absolutely make that worthwhile to make sure an MSK radiologist reads the report. Interprets the report for you.
Ash, can I just add a little comment as well? I think since the guideline was published, there have been a few papers highlighting the problems with, perhaps you could describe it as, oversensitivity of MRI imaging. And there have been some really interesting work to suggest that MRI of the sacroiliac joints in women who have given birth in the last 6 to 8 months can sometimes give appearances very suspicious of inflammatory axial spondyloarthritis. And it's thought to relate to ligamentous stretching during pregnancy. And I think just be aware of the kind of the false positive imaging, because it can lead to a perhaps erroneous diagnosis and an incorrect management intervention and exposure to unnecessary medication. And I think, you know, if we're being honest, we've probably all got these patients who have, you know, widespread musculoskeletal pain. They have some inflammatory back pain features. They might have a bit of NSAID response. They may have had a baby, or they may have been involved in very physical work. They've gone on to have an MRI scan, which has been reported as showing bone marrow edema of the sacroiliac joints. And then they get a diagnosis of non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis and get exposed to biologic therapy, to which they tend not to respond. And I think it's just to be cautious. There's no black and white approach to dealing with this problem, but I think it's just really important that we're all aware of this as a possibility to try and be mindful of trying to really pin down the diagnosis. Mm. Obviously, if the patient is HLA-B27 positive, that adds more weight to any MRI imaging and makes you much more suspicious. This is a true inflammatory back pain. But I think we still come and stuck sometimes in patients in that situation.
Yeah. So going on to treatment then, we know that the first line treatment is obviously non-steroidal therapy and a trial of two non-steroidal treatments. But then our first line therapy in terms of biologic treatment is effective in terms of the TNF inhibitor therapies. Would you have any comments about additional treatment options that we have now since the guidelines? Biologic treatments in terms of spondyloarthropathy in general have changed in the last number of years. So would you have any comments just about new treatments on the market?
I'm going to start off by talking about NSAIDs. I think when we did the NICE guidance, somebody did a very, very sophisticated network analysis to try and compare all the different NSAIDs with each other to see whether there was evidence that one NSAID was more effective at managing spondyloarthritis symptoms. And after very much work, it was all decided that there was not enough evidence to say that one NSAID had any benefit over other NSAIDs with regard to efficacy. Now, all NSAIDs have side effects, and some have more side effects than others. But more recently, there has been a recent paper that has highlighted that etoricoxib does seem to be more effective for managing axial spondyloarthritis pain. So starting off with pharmacotherapy for my AS patients, if they haven't had exposure to etoricoxib at a 60 milligram per day dose, then I will always give them a trial of that. And I've had some patients who, you know, I think that they're teetering on the edge of needing high cost drug therapy for managing their inflammatory spondyloarthritis. And we've given them a trial of etoricoxib, and they've bounced back into the clinic and they said, I feel really good. Why didn't I have this drug ages ago? I sound like I'm being sponsored by the company, I'm not. Mm-hmm. But I think it's certainly worth giving patients a good trial of etoricoxib before stepping up to high cost drug therapy. So at the moment, NICE technology appraisals allow us to use a variety of anti-TNF therapies. And there has been some restriction on exposure to some medications to treat non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis, as most high-cost drugs have had their license initially for treating ankylosing spondylitis or radiographic axial spondyloarthritis. Golimumab has been approved for non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis since the guideline was published, so that is now an option in addition to the other anti-TNF therapies. And obviously with the fall in price with biosimilar anti-TNF therapies, infliximab now is an accepted treatment if it's a biosimilar version of the medication for treatment of axial spondyloarthritis and ankylosing spondylitis. The IL-17 inhibitors, so secukinumab and ixekizumab, at the moment secukinumab is licensed for use to treat ankylosing spondylitis. And I understand that in July 21, we're anticipating a decision with regard to use of ixekizumab for ankylosing spondylitis and for non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis. And it's likely that secukinumab will also get approval for treatment of non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis. So it's exciting times with introduction of JAK inhibitors. There is emerging evidence that upadacitinib appears to be effective for managing symptoms of axial spondyloarthritis, but as yet, that you know, there's no license for that indication or NICE approval for use of that medication in the UK. But you know, we're excited about the prospects of having a drug with a different mode of action to treat these troublesome AxSpA patients. And it's interesting, I'm sure you're aware of this, Ash, when you see patients in clinic, you think this is straightforward, we'll go to a high-cost drug therapy. And then when you actually look into their background, they've got a history of malignancy in the last few years, so you want to avoid anti-TNF therapy, and then they have some bowel symptoms, and then you want to avoid using an IL-17 inhibitor. And then you're kind of a bit stuck, really. And you know, our treatment armamentarium for, you know, axial spondyloarthritis in the high-cost drug arena is actually fairly restrictive. So I think it would be really useful to have more treatment options with different modes of action to use in our patients.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So, Carol, then, is there any non-pharmacology management tips then? Obviously, physiotherapy input is so important. How would you envisage the best way in which there would be physiotherapy input for patients with axial disease?
I think the combination of exercise and people being really active is really important alongside all the amazing medication options that there are that can be quite life-changing, and not everybody can take them or respond to them, so that can make the exercise aspect even more important. And I guess for caring for someone, it's trying to be patient-centered. So everybody comes with different challenges. So, you know, the exercise strategies are probably not rocket science. They're really about, you know, maintaining strength and range of movement in all the directions we need our spine to go in, and keeping it aerobically fit. For many, the option of hydrotherapy in the pool, hopefully, is something that's offered to people if they're keen for it. And the option of individualized care or group care, and often lots of value in group care. And, of course, with COVID, really changed the nature of input and expanded what might be options for people. So what's available online, and also the digital strategy that help us support people, and how we might do our measurements and our monitoring. So the apps that have become available are really super important. But there's all the other aspects that are important to address. You know, people's mood can be really impacted. Workability, fatigue, you know, the excitement of having, you know, planning a family and I guess what happens around that, and having a family, so what you bring to that from a physiotherapist perspective for people that, you know, through their pregnancy can be really super important. The other really important aspect, of course, are the ways that exercise and activity are really important for the other complications or risk factors. So the cardiovascular risk factors and osteoporosis and metabolic syndrome that can be associated with inflammatory disease. So, you know, they're really key as well, and it's really a long-term approach. So our challenge, I guess, is to make people being really prepared to engage in long-term activity and exercise. And there's no-no-nos. There's nothing they can't do according to what they'd like to do and achieve. So our challenge is to help them do that and really support their self-management. And there's lots of resources now. We're really, really lucky to be able to signpost them to amazing resources that are now there through NASS, through the PAPAA, and through Versus Arthritis. So, it's completely expanded, I think, in the last year or so with COVID, and delighted to be able to use those resources to support people. And also, absolutely thank you to all the colleagues that have done all that work to help make them provided. For health professionals, A-Stretch is a group that works really hard to support education but also the provision of care. So the A-Stretch website and that amazing group is also provides a really valuable resource in education and in care strategies. So I'd just really like to signpost those.
I'm just going to echo some of Carol's points there. I think during COVID lockdown, the lack of access to swimming pools really impacted on the AxSpA patients. And even now there's relatively restricted access to council-owned pools. But we're hoping that as things open up and our patients can get back in the pool and do their water-based exercise under their own steam, as well as in conjunction with hydrotherapy teams, we're hoping that they will start to feel a little bit better. I've had a number of patients who've really flared very badly because they used to swim very regularly and that was all put on hold with COVID. I do think if we can encourage pools to be flexible and allow our patients back in, that will actually have great benefit for the patients going forward.
Mm. Yeah, very interesting. So Nicolaitin, just in terms of NICE guidelines in general and then just implementing NICE guidance into practice, do you have any tips for clinicians in general or for healthcare providers?
I think it's difficult, isn't it? And I think we're constantly being asked to provide evidence that we're following NICE guidelines, and I think you can have these sort of fairly superficial audits that suggest that you're doing all the right things at your end. It's difficult with NICE guidelines that span across the kind of the health journey that patients go through, and I think one of the most important things that's come out of this NICE guidance for spondyloarthritis has been the work trying to highlight this as a potential diagnosis in patients with back pain. And the kind of the identification that there's so much delay before patients get a diagnosis and the impact that this has on patients presenting late and getting a diagnosis late is manifest. And I think anything we can do to try and speed up that process is really positive. So one of the things that we've tried to do is to increase our education. So implementing NICE guidelines is difficult, particularly when the guideline spans primary and secondary care. One of the things that's really important is trying to educate people involved in assessing patients presenting with back pain to try and speed up the timed diagnosis. And I think even in the UK, there's still a very prolonged period where patients have symptoms going back, 8, 10, sometimes 11 years in our area before they actually get a diagnosis of axial spondyloarthritis. And I know NASS are doing an awful lot of work to try and speed up this patient journey to getting a diagnosis, because we recognise that patients with chronic inflammatory back pain that's not being adequately managed impact on their life course in a significant way, partly because these patients often present in kind of late teenage, early 20s, when they're, actually developing their personality and their career and their life goals are all being influenced by this. So an early diagnosis can actually make a really big long-term difference to patients, particularly if we can manage their symptoms well with physical and pharmacotherapy. There are lots of things that are actually ongoing. I think NASS have been working with Raj Sengupta to try and actually get some IT interventions in primary care to help identify these patients. And I think Raj has been working with their primary care IT systems to actually have pop-ups that kind of pop up whenever the GP types in something that's suggestive of inflammatory back pain or a patient with spondyloarthritis features. So I think that could help just raise awareness, even if it's just by an automated pop-up, to actually get people to think, is this axial spondyloarthritis or is this mechanical back pain? So I think that's really important. As I mentioned before, you know, demonstrating you're actually implementing NICE guidance can rely on audits. And I think that's really, really important to actually look at what we're doing now. Are we actually following NICE guidelines? Are there things that we should be doing differently? And should we be developing quality improvement projects to actually speed up and improve our management of these patients with axial spondyloarthritis? I think Carol mentioned earlier the first contact practitioner as a group of people that were really, really important that we are engaged with to ensure education and recognition of inflammatory back pain. Because often we see patients in secondary care who have a diagnosis with a very prolonged period of delay, and they may have attended their GP practice on a number of occasions with their back pain, and nobody's thought about it. So actually having a team of enthusiastic first contact practitioners who are aware of this as a potential diagnosis in the younger patient presenting with back pain will hopefully lead to shorter delay before diagnosis and the appropriate treatment can be implemented. So I think that could potentially really improve things. What do you think, Carol?
Absolutely. What you said is just so key. And as you were speaking, I was thinking every region, every service, spinal service needs to have an inflammatory back pain pathway. And we need to treat these people as a 3-week inflammatory condition, not a chronic low back pain. And so I think hopefully with all the education we're doing, we're able to get them much more about what to screen for, you know, when to be strongly suspicious, to use their services, to link in with the services, and maybe part of the inflammatory back pain is having an advice and guidance sort of service that, you know, they're not all the time, you know, but they're some of the time, and I think that would be really, really valuable. So absolutely the work of NASS, I think how we can just do much better at screening and get them to have the chance to be investigated and diagnosed. There are a few things I was thinking about that we didn't speak about, and there's some of the myths. And so the things around inflammatory markers and sort of expecting inflammatory markers to be raised in this population, and they're often not, and they may never be. So, blood tests are important for lots of reasons for screening for various things and or for, you know, thinking about differential diagnoses, but not to exclude somebody if they've got normal inflammatory markers. Or if they've got HBLA 27 positive, but that was just one of the myths. And also that we see axial spondylitis occur in women and men equally. So we sort of historically thought it was, you know, a young male's disease, and that's what older people like me grew up with. But really, you know, it's equally common in women, and it may present a little bit differently, and maybe. And Nick, you could just talk about if there are any relevant gender differences, but we need to think about it in women as well. Just some thoughts I was thinking about.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. And Nikki, finally to you, is there any other points that you would like to raise that we haven't covered?
Well, one of the things that came up as a research recommendation from the guidelines was to understand comorbidity of axial spondyloarthritis. This is a massive problem. And I think when you look at young patients with this diagnosis, there's a really high rate of lots of different comorbidities. But one of the comorbidities that's particularly important is psychological comorbidities. These patients have a much higher rate of anxiety and depression. And this is really important as it impacts on obviously their quality of life, but also impacts on their response to treatment and probably contributes to some of their delay to getting diagnosis. Obviously there's more research needs to be done in this area, but actually having a condition that starts when you're a very young adult will impact on so many more things rather than just your musculoskeletal system. And particularly if you feel like you're not really understood or people don't really, you know, that you go to your GP or you've got back pain, and it's almost, you can almost see that, so, you know, this is, oh gosh, chronic back pain, here we go again. And I'm sure that happens a few times, and the patient then doesn't go back because they feel that they're not getting any clear understanding or investigation or management that's helping them. So having psychological comorbidity is really important. We know that when patients with anxiety and depression or other psychological morbidities are treated with high-cost drugs, they respond, but they never get their disease activity scores down to the level of somebody without psychological morbidity. So psychological morbidity in rheumatic diseases is very prevalent, and it's something, you know, we're aware of in rheumatoid arthritis and psoriatic arthritis, but it does seem to be particularly problematic in axial spondyloarthritis. So raising awareness of this and having access to interventions that could be helpful to manage psychological morbidity alongside axial spondyloarthritis is really, really important. Other comorbidities that I'm particularly interested in is osteoporosis. So when I started running a specialist clinic, I started sending some of my young male patients down to the DEXA department to get their bone density assessed. And this raised lots of awareness, and I got quite a few bounced referrals. Now it's accepted that these, you know, younger patients can have quite marked reduction in their bone density, increase in their risk of fracture. And so we now do regular DEXA imaging in most of our axial spondyloarthritis patients. And it forms part of their annual review. Obviously, they don't get a DEXA every year. We usually do a DEXA every 2 to 3 years, unless they've got completely normal bone density. And then we do it once every 5 years. But again, this isn't evidence-based, this is eminence-based decision-making. The other issue with DEXA that's quite complicated is if you do a spinal DEXA on somebody who's got lots of syndesmophytes or a fused spine, their spinal bone density will look fabulous, but actually their fracture risk will still be massively increased, as they're likely to have osteoporosis in their vertebra. So trabecular bone will be affected, but cortical bone less so. And they'll often have a very stiff, rigid spine, so minor knocks can actually cause quite significant spinal fractures. So I think it's just to be aware of the difficulty with interpreting DEXA imaging in the patient with ankylosing spondylitis. And that's certainly something I'd ask people to be mindful of. It's always the thing, isn't it, that when you're doing A&E, you know, the patient who comes in with severe neck pain after minor trauma, if they have a diagnosis of ankylosing spondylitis, then these are the patients that need imaging, because some of these patients can actually go on to have significant spinal cord damage after a vertebral fracture. So I think those are kind of just points that, you know, the horror stories that we come across every now and then. You know, it's important to be aware of this to try and avoid missing something that could cause the patient significant harm.
Great. Thank you so much. Yeah, that's been really, really, really interesting. Nikki and Carol, thanks so much for your time and providing all this information to this podcast. So thank you.
Thank you, Ash.
See you both. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Talking Rheumatology Spotlight, brought to you by BSR. Please do rate, share and subscribe through your favourite podcast app.